Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do Spain and Uganda have in common? Well, not much, it turns out, which helps explain the Spanish bailouts this weekend. Why we pay what we pay for healthcare, and no, it's not just doctors and insurance companies. And are you an iPhone person or an Android person? It's Apple versus Google on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 11th of June. Good to have you with us. And I know you read the business and economic headlines on Saturday, saw that Spain had gotten a $125 billion bailout, and you said, look, the European debt crisis is over. I hate to break it to you, but that's just not the way the global economy works. You know, to explain exactly how bailouts do work nowadays, though, we've got our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, on the line with us. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So in a nutshell here, what happened?
Sure. Well, you know the Monty Python line, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Well,
yes.
Everybody expected a Spanish bailout, which is what this is. It's not a bailout of the banks. It's a bailout of Spain's government. Try to wrap your mind around this, okay? It's the banks bailing out the government, which is bailing out the banks.
All right. You got to explain that. Help me out.
Yeah. Here's how we can tell. So about 2 weeks ago, we were hearing about a Spanish bank bailout that would be about 37 billion euros.
Right.
Last week, 60 billion euros. Today, 100 billion euros. What does that tell us? The banks aren't swallowing that much bad debt. It tells us that there's a bigger use, and that's probably the government's use. The Spanish government is in trouble. It's the fourth largest economy in the eurozone.
Right.
And so they want to avoid this look of another bailout. So calling it a bank bailout makes it look better.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of makes sense. Speaking of the whole fourth largest economy thing, let me ask you this. There were reports this weekend and early this morning of this text message that the Spanish prime minister sent to his finance minister in the heat of these negotiations. And he said to his finance guy, hold on, wait a minute. We have some leverage. We are the fourth largest economy in the eurozone. Spain is not Uganda, he said. So now do the Spaniards and the Italians and anybody who's big and who comes later, do they have leverage over the eurozone and the Germans?
Far more than Uganda, which isn't even in the eurozone. So I question his geography as well as his texting skills. But yes, Spain does have leverage now. And here's why. Because everyone knows that a breakup of the eurozone would hurt every country in the eurozone.
Right.
It's not as easy as we talk about. And it certainly emboldens other countries to ask for better terms. Spain's getting good terms. Suddenly, everybody's going back to the drawing table and saying, hey, we're Greece, we're Italy, we're Portugal, we're Ireland. We want this to look better for us. And before you know it, it's chaos.
Right. And we'll actually get to that in a bit with Stephen's beer piece, which is coming up at the bottom of the show. But let me ask you another sort of more macro thing. And you and I talked about this in the financial crisis here. You know, you can recapitalize and bail out bad debt until the cows come home, right? But until somebody takes the loss, it's a bad debt on the books. Has this done anything to alleviate the fundamental problem in Spain and in Europe?
No, because the fundamental problem is, as you mentioned, denial. And this does nothing to avoid that denial. I mean, Spain's property bubble popped, think about this, around the same time as ours, back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just taking those losses now. So they pushed off that pain for 4 years. That's the extent of European denial. I asked somebody in Europe about this who's been watching this carefully. His name is Anthony Peters. He's a chief strategist with Swiss Invest in London. And he told us not to even try to compare this to our property bubble. That's how big Spain's problem is.
Ireland and Spain makes the property bubble in the United States look like a kid's toy. We are talking really, really serious problems.
And by way of example, he pointed out there's a house in Ireland for every single Irishman. That's how much they overbuilt.
You'd think we planned it this way, but we really didn't. Ireland coming up later in the broadcast with Stephen Beard. That was Heidi Moore in New York City for us. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Guy.
All right. We'll see you later. On Wall Street today, yeah, you know, you'd have thought it had been better with the bailout and all, but not so much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Politics in this country, and policy as well nowadays, is almost entirely wrapped up in the message Campaigns and special interest groups want to make sure everybody who's on their side is all on the same page. Hence, widely distributed talking points, ad campaigns, daily message meetings, and now even smartphone apps, for crying out loud. There's one out today aimed at keeping the financial advisors industry saying the same thing. And the art of getting a talking point to break out beyond the Washington, D.C. beltway to, say, the farmers of Nebraska, turns out it's quite an industry. We asked Marketplace's David Gura to follow the message.
I was in Nebraska a few months ago, and Brad Heinrichs, a corn farmer, started telling me about how much he loves his job. He gets to work with his brother and his dad
on a day-to-day basis, and try to grow something to feed, to feed the world.
And that phrase, to feed the world, is something I heard over and over again. Here's another corn farmer, Mark Jagels.
I mean, if my yields triple, wow. We'll produce it, to feed the world.
I realized the phrase had caught on when I left Nebraska, and I heard this last week.
Farmers and ranchers in my state truly help feed, but we have said again and again, a troubled and hungry world.
It wasn't just in every farmer's lexicon. Politicians were also using it. That's Kansas Senator Pat Roberts. I wondered where this phrase came from, so I called the National Corn Growers Association. Janice Walters says she thinks it started with the farmers.
So this is not a phrase that the Corn Growers Association came up with?
I don't believe so.
The American Farm Bureau Federation said the same thing, but the lobbyists have embraced it. The phrase showed up in an Agriculture Council of America memo about a decade ago. So maybe that's how long it takes for talking points to travel from a trade group to its membership, or at least that's how long it used to take. Today, the Financial Services Institute released a smartphone app to push its message to its members. Chris Politz does communications for the group.
It was very hard to break through to your own membership and really get them to pay attention to what's critical.
Politz says this is how the Washington message machine works today and how it will deliver talking points in the future. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We're counting down to mere days until the Supreme Court shares its thoughts on the health care reform law. And the ruling will doubtless talk about constitutionality and the individual mandate and the Commerce Clause and maybe about the rising cost of health care in this country. So to that end, who do you suppose sets the price of individual medical procedures? If you said insurance companies or the government, you're only half right. Because the prices your insurance company pays are based on a set of values listed in a phone book-sized directory of billing codes. And those codes are pretty much the economic hierarchy of modern medicine. They say what costs more, a colonoscopy or a CT scan or chemotherapy. And those values are set by a closed-door committee of the American Medical Association. At the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner has been trying to figure out how that committee works.
It's called the Relative Value Update Committee, but everyone knows it as the RUC. It's a committee of the AMA, meets every 4 months in a hotel conference room. And right here, this being a radio story, is where I'd play you sound of one of those meetings.
Can I have everybody's attention, please?
You might hear heated debates between some three dozen doctors over what procedures should be worth and which ones Medicare should pay higher prices for. But I can't play you that sound, because RUC meetings are invitation only. Observers are sworn to secrecy. Even the names of the doctors on this private committee were until recently kept confidential. For those who have been before the RUC, it's a powerful experience.
I've never sat before Congress, but a congressional committee, but it is like sitting before a committee that is the final determiner.
Dr. Richard Wagesbeck is with the American Academy of Otolaryngology, that's ear, nose, and throat docs. It's been his job to come before the RUC to defend his specialty's procedures.
And to make sure that they're properly valued.
The value of a medical procedure, the fee paid to the doctor, is figured out by adding up hundreds of tiny variables, from how many average minutes of time the doctor might spend to how many rolls of gauze he might use. These variables are measured and voted on by the RUC. For example, Dr. Wagesbeck recently presented a new procedure to the RUC called balloon sinus surgery. In this treatment, a tiny plastic balloon is used to widen your sinus cavity. And in this case, the physician does not spend many minutes of time, but the supplies are expensive. $2,600 for a little plastic balloon, and you got to buy a new balloon for every patient. So that was factored into the price. While the exact dollar amount varies a lot by geography and other factors, the average fee is around $3,000 per sinus. Here's Dr. Wagesbeck.
It was felt that these balloons would be used one per sinus.
But doctors use the same balloon for up to 6 sinuses, billing Medicare $18,000 for extra balloons that they didn't need or buy.
Some people were expressing concern that this appeared to be an undue windfall.
It would be kind of like your mechanic changed your 4 tires and charged you for 4 sets of wrenches. Except that would be fraud. In this case, the way the RUC set the value, the doctors have no choice but to overcharge.
The system didn't work, okay? And it didn't work with everyone having good intentions.
Dr. Charles Koopman has served on the RUC for 20 years, as long as there's been a RUC. So he's got a lot of experience with valuing codes. And he's also the lone ear, nose, and throat doctor on the RUC, which means that if anyone in the room that day might have realized that doctors could use the same balloon multiple times, it would have been him.
Did it enter my mind? It really didn't. All we wanted to do is make sure that the cost got covered for a sinus that you were operating on, and that we were successful in. And it turns out we were awfully successful.
I talked to a number of ENT surgeons. All of them said that most doctors in their field should know that you could reuse a balloon in multiple sinuses. Tom Salzer is an otolaryngologist in Texas.
Yeah, I think that they would understand that for 2 reasons. One is it's common sense.
And the second reason is the device company owned by Johnson & Johnson will hold your hand every step of the way.
They'll come to your office. You have to do a certain number of them in the operating room, and then they are there for your first several to help you through them.
Yet, apparently, no one came to help Charles Koopman or the other doctors on the RUC that priced this procedure. A central criticism of the RUC is its exclusivity. It has no health economists, no patient groups on its board. RUC members primarily hear from and are chosen by physician specialty societies.
Doctors end up coming in and lobbying for their own interests. Having a seat on the RUC is a pathway to do that.
Brian Klepper is a healthcare analyst in Florida. When he says lobbying, you don't have to imagine Washington types with bags of money. He says it's sort of built into the process. When the RUC wants to measure those hundreds of variables that go into valuing a code, the first thing that happens is that specialists on the RUC survey other specialists in the profession.
When the RUC is evaluating a procedure, they make it known to the society. The society sends out notices that it would be really good if all of our members responded to this because, you know, the way you respond is going to be directly reflected in how we get paid.
Officially, the RUC plays only an advisory role. But a study in Health Affairs last month found that Medicare accepts that advice 90% of the time. Remember, we're talking about $80 billion of taxpayer money. But the RUC is even more powerful than that, because Medicare's reimbursement rates are used as the basis for almost every private insurance company in the country.
This is the platform that decides how we pay providers.
Charlie Baker is the former CEO of the Harvard Pilgrim Health Plan, a not-for-profit insurer in Massachusetts. He says if you want to know what's wrong in healthcare, Google the RUC.
By having a process that, for all intents and purposes, isn't a public process and doesn't appear to actually be accountable to much of anybody, I think that's kind of un-American.
Medicare officials tell me that they are pushing back against the influence of specialists. They've started something called the Misvalued Codes Initiative, and they say that new codes often come into the world with mistakes in them, and Medicare can address them. This year, Medicare reduced the fee paid for balloon sinus surgery by 43%, so a little less of a windfall. Don Berwick was formerly director of CMS. That's the federal agency that runs Medicare.
Remember, there are thousands of codes that are in play in any year.
And hundreds of thousands of variables that go into pricing them.
It would take a long time, years, for CMS, even if it had the resources, to go back over every single code and make an independent judgment from what the RUC has made.
The irony is this, he says. As long as we've agreed to pay doctors by adding up all the hundreds of specialized things that a doctor does in the course of a procedure, the only people with the expertise to sort through all these variables will be other doctors. So for better or worse, he says, Medicare is stuck with the RUC, because for now, there's no one else. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
We've got more about the RUC on our website, including from the American Medical Association, what the RUC is and isn't. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, what's the difference between an iPhone and an Android phone, you ask?
If there's a 27-year-old, beautiful, super stylish girl by the pool in Palm Springs, there's a much higher chance she's using an iPhone.
Which explains why I got mine this weekend, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, for the first time in five trading days, the Dow Industrials lost ground. It fell 142 points, 1.1%, 12,411. The NASDAQ retreated 48 points, around 1.2%, 2809. The S&P 500 down 16 points, 1.25%, 1308. Citigroup stock fell 4.5% today. Bank of America shares withdrew 3.75%. Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase each declined about 2.5%. Companies with global exposure also suffered. Shares of Alcoa sheared off nearly 2.5% today. Caterpillar stock dug down by 2.75%. Bond prices rose. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.59%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for May. The League of Women Voters concludes its 50th National Convention in the nation's capital. And the United Nations observes World Day Against Child Labor. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back to Europe in this part of the program and the trickle-down from that very generous $125 billion bailout that Spain's going to get. If you were thinking European countries that have already been bailed out are going to say, in essence, hey, how do we get a deal like that? Well, they already are. The Greek anti-austerity party wants fresh terms for its bailout. And in Ireland, the deputy finance minister is trying to convince people their aid package was, quote, just as attractive. How all that's playing down at the corner pub, though? Well, that's a whole nother story. A story, actually, that Stephen Beard is going to be telling us all week in a series we're calling A Man Walks Into a Bar.
A man walks into a bar, he says, give me a Bacardi and Coke.
Our man in Europe has spent the past week pub crawling through five European cities, asking everyday bar patrons and teetotalers alike what they think of the debt crisis. He starts today in Ireland.
Kennedy's Pub in Ballyhea, County Cork. For the past 30 years, it's been a kind of second village hall, but cosier. The ceilings are low. Polished wood and brass fittings gleam reassuringly. On the walls, photos of Irish sports teams basking in past victories. But the present isn't so cheery. It's 9 o'clock on a Friday night and there are barely a dozen people here. You might think whatever the crisis is doing, it's not driving the Irish to drink. But landlady Yvonne Kennedy has a different take.
I will be berated for this, but my opinion is that Irish people medicate, celebrate. We do everything with alcohol and we do it to excess.
She says people are drinking plenty, but at home, where it's cheaper, if not as convivial as here in the bar. Local warehouseman Pat Maloney has seen his income cut in half during the downturn.
Going out, coming to the pub here, it's very seldom we come out anymore.
How often do you come to this pub?
Oh, this pub, I said this is the second time I've been here in 5 years. We just can't afford it.
2 hours later, a few more drinkers have drifted into Kennedy's. The booze has been flowing copiously. People are starting to unwind.
I'll have a gin and tonic, please. I'll have a gin and tonic, please, and a brandy for the alcoholic over there with the red hair.
But stony-faced and stone-cold sober in the adjoining pool room sits another local and pub regular, Dermot O'Flynn.
It is ludicrous what's happening. It is unprecedented what's happening. Bullying and blackmailing the Irish government and the Irish people into assuming a debt that is not theirs.
He says the European Central Bank failed to stop Ireland's property bubble inflating. Then it pressured the government to bail out all the banks, saddling the taxpayer with huge debts. Dermot organises a regular local protest march. And he says when he goes around the county with his campaign, he sees real anger.
The people who got the hottest reception were the people who stood up and spoke about violence.
Threatened violence.
Threatened violence. It's time for the gun, it's time for the bullet. And I'm telling you, there's that undercurrent here of people who I think, are ready to just explode.
It's now 11 o'clock and the mood has mellowed. Dermot and others are singing a lament to the centuries of oppression that Ireland has suffered.
Irish ways and Irish laws, villagers of Irish blood.
Francis O'Brien, a 73-year-old dairy farmer, says Ireland is now run by foreigners, by the Germans and the French. She says Ireland's freedom fighters, who won independence from the British yoke, would be appalled.
Oh, how would they turn in their grave? They gave their lives to give us freedom, and we've handed it.
Handed away your independence and your sovereignty.
Our sovereignty, really, because other people are deciding what's happening in our country now.
The crisis has touched everyone in this pub. Teacher Fiona Fitzpatrick has seen many young friends lose their jobs and then emigrate, and she's fretting about the future.
I am a mother. I'm a mother to three children who I absolutely adore, and I really want my children to have a chance here, and I just feel their future has been stolen away. Having to leave your country because you have to, because you don't have work here, that's not what I want for my children.
Just before Kennedy's closed, at 1 o'clock in the morning, some regulars sang this sad little song about the death of some Irish fishermen in a storm off the coast of Donegal. Dermot O'Flynn says Ireland is also at sea.
This thing is just going from bad to worse. And it is. It is going from bad to worse. And God knows where it's going to end up.
At Kennedy's Pub in Ballyhea, County Cork, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A night in an Irish pub gets you more than just a four-minute radio story, don't you know? Stephen's reporter's notebook is on our website. Tomorrow, he wanders into a bar in Paris. And we are tracking one very specific economic indicator during this series, the price of a pint of beer. What do you drink and what do you pay? Tweet us at MarketplaceAPM with the hashtag EconPubCrawl. That's EconPubCrawl. Or go to marketplace.org. There's a map of beer prices there from all over the world. Add yours. First things first, as we turn to the technology news of the day and the big Apple conference that got going in San Francisco this morning. No iPhone 5 yet. There are going to be some new MacBooks. And as rumor had it last week, new software that kicks Google Maps straight out to the curb. And that might actually be the most interesting story in mobile technology right now. The Hatfield and McCoy thing that Apple and Google have going. Which is to say, between the iPhone and smartphones using Google's Android operating system. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports that feud is as much about culture as it is about technology.
Remember those old TV commercials about Mac and PC? Mac's the easygoing cool guy in the t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And PC's the pudgy, pasty guy in the ill-fitting sports coat, khakis, and loafers.
And I'm a PC.
Well, this tech boom, there's a similar culture war being waged in big cities across America. Only this one is about smartphones. And Apple has a new rival, Google's Android. In the U.S., Android has about 50% of the market, while iPhone has around 30%. I went out to observe the warring tribes in their urban habitat in Berkeley.
I almost assume that everybody has an iPhone. And then when they don't, I'm surprised.
What runs through your mind when they don't?
They're not cool. Or they can't afford it.
Sonia Balcazar is an admin assistant and actress. She's with her boyfriend, Alex Garcia, who's an Android user, and this is causing a little tension. Garcia says iPhone users are too cultish.
It's a little too much. I don't want to develop a friendship with my phone where, like, my phone's like my new girlfriend.
And what do you think of Android users?
What? Who? There are still Android users?
You can't blame her for falling for Garcia. He's 30, storybook tall, dark, and handsome, and in a stylish designer-looking shirt. Which, according to one market study, doesn't fit the profile of your typical Android user. Androids are huge among teens, and the guys live in t-shirts, jeans, and sneakers. For more insight into the Android user, I turn to John Gargiulo, the head of marketing at BlueStacks. It's a startup that caters to Android users, and so part of his job is to understand them.
If you're standing in Muncie, Indiana, you're more likely to be surrounded by people using Android devices.
Gargiulo says that the average Android user isn't as affluent as the iPhone user, and that more men use Androids than women.
Politically pretty conservative, certainly more so than iPhone users, with a slightly larger than average head, according to what they've reported.
Can you spot an iPhone user?
You can try.
But can you?
Oh, can I? If there's a 27-year-old, beautiful, super stylish girl by the pool in Palm Springs, there's a much higher chance she's using an iPhone.
And looking at Gargiulo's head, which is pretty normal, I figured out he's an iPhone user. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it's a correction of sorts. We were talking on Friday about how silver bullets can kill vampires. And one of you, you know who you are, tweeted us to say we got it all wrong. It's silver bullets for werewolves, guys, not vampires, he said. So we called somebody who knows way more about these kinds of things than we do, author Anne Rice, and we asked her.
Well, he's absolutely right. Traditionally, a silver bullet is supposed to kill a werewolf. Vampires are not particularly affected by silver bullets. Traditionally, what kills vampires is a wooden stake through the heart. Now, that doesn't affect my vampires.
What about the clove of garlic and the holding up of the cross and all that stuff?
Well, that doesn't affect my vampires either, but traditionally, that does paralyze vampires and force them to back off.
Anne Rice on vampires. I mean, who else are you going to call, right? She's into werewolves now, too, by the way. Her new book is called The Wolf Gift. You can hear the rest of our chat at marketplace.org. Today, the Dow gave back 142 points. That's about 1.1%. The NASDAQ off 48 points, 1 2/3%. The S&P 500 down 16 points, 1 1/4%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.